I'd like to call this meeting of the House Transportation Committee to order. It is currently 1:05 p.m. on Thursday, March 5th, in room 124. Members present today are Representative St. Clair, Representative Nelson, Representative Mina, Co-Chair Eichheid, and myself, Co-Chair Carrick. Let the record reflect we do have a quorum to conduct business, and please take this time to silence your cell phones. Before we begin, I'd like to thank Jordan Nicholson from House Records, Jude Augustine from the Juno LIO, and our committee aides, my staff, Griffin Sukeo, and Meredith Trainer from my co-chair's office. Thank you all for your help in staffing the committee today. On today's agenda, we are hearing a presentation from the Department of Transportation on innovation and the future of transportation in Alaska with Christine Langley, Director of Data, Modernization, and Innovation, and our trusty legislative liaison, Andy Mills. Welcome to the House Transportation Committee, Ms. Langley and Mr. Mills, and if you'd like to put yourselves on the record and go ahead and start the presentation.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For the record, Andy Mills, Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant, both titles, at the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
For the record, Christine Langley, Data Modernization and Innovation Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
And Andy Mills, for the record, thank you, Madam Co-Chair, for the opportunity, both of you, for the opportunity to come before this committee. So you asked for a presentation that showed you some of the things that DOT is doing to innovate. And as you've heard from our commissioner in previous presentations, both last year and this year, we kind of stand on three pillars at DOT of what's kind of trying to guide the agile, modern, and resilient, right? You've heard those. And this is the modern piece. What can we do to innovate that has our operations being either more efficient or maybe extending into areas where there's a need for us to grow into? And technology can serve both of those purposes, sometimes simultaneously. And so we have a suite of slides here that kind of run the gamut of different pieces of technology. We've tried to frame this presentation on things that we've executed on very recently or things we're working on right now. There are a lot of really fascinating topics that are in front of us in the future. I know, so this committee has obviously heard about autonomous vehicles in another piece of legislation. That's a fascinating area of conversation. And there are a whole suite of other sort of mid to long-term technologies that we will not be covering in this presentation, but certainly there's a lot happening in the transportation sector in general. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Langley to kick us off on these.
For the record, Christine Langley. So as Mr. Mills shared, transportation's future is technology, right? And that's not just what we're doing today, but it's how we get to tomorrow. And currently, we use technology throughout the department. We innovate towards what we might use in the future. And we're going to cover many of the innovations that DOT has done, not all of the innovations that DOT has done. And as we assembled this presentation, it was actually really hard to have this enormous collection of great ideas and get it into some semblance of order. So today we're going to talk about our use of robots, drones, artificial intelligence. We're going to talk about what we're doing in Avalanche, how we're supporting industry, and where we know transportation is going in the future. So as all of you know, Alaska has a unique transportation challenge. We are land, air, and sea. We have vast stretches that have no, what lower 48 states would perceive to be common connections. We have extreme weather and rapidly changing conditions. And we need to maximize the limited resources that we have. And that's both staff, that's money, that's, you know, available ability to connect to our communities. And so modernization in all of these areas is part of how we're getting there. So we can start right off the bat with robots. In the upper right is Archimedes. Archimedes is an underwater robot. It helps look at our docks, our harbors, our piers, and allows us to get eyes in an area that otherwise we would have had to wait until we could find a diver. There's a cost to having a diver on site, and then, of course, we have to get that information relayed visually back. This allows experts on land to take a look at what's going on underwater so that we can make those best decisions on what steps might need to be taken next. On the left is Aurora. Aurora is our wildlife mitigation robot dog. It is stationed at the Fairbanks International Airport. It's used for mitigation of wildlife that is on the runway. In addition to that, it can be used to get into areas that might otherwise be unsafe. So it can get into small spaces, it can get into a culvert, it could go underneath a building. There's a lot of benefits to being able to send a robot in somewhere that either is unsafe for a person or that a person would not fit. DOT has 130 drones. Currently, we do need to phase out DJI drones. This is a particular brand. That's going to leave us with 65 drones. So this is an area that we're going to focus on this year to make sure that that program continues to be robust. When the drones are up and operating, they need to get us that information back. And so one of the ways we do that is through our ability to deploy Starlink panels around the state. And this has really grown our communication network and our ability to respond to an area that maybe we don't have an existing building or infrastructure or staff located. Drones help us support all of our sections within DOT and really allow us, as you can see from these visual images, to gain information that you just can't get when you're standing on the ground. The fact that we are, drones kind of show that cycle of innovation, right? They were a new thing at one point, they became a steady use thing next, and then eventually they really built out that ability to respond that you saw in the West Coast storm. That wasn't something that we spun up overnight. That was the fact that we were using drones already. We had mechanisms for moving that data. We had staff that had licenses and were ready to go, and we were able to rapidly respond to an emergency because of our daily use.
And we have a question here, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, could you explain why you're phasing out the DJI drones, please?
And for the record, Andy Mills. So the DJI is a Chinese-based company, and those are being phased out primarily because while early entry to the market, those were a low-cost, sort of high-tech solution. The Build America, Buy America provisions have required that spending federal funds, our program should transition to, and Ms. Langley has a demo here, which we love hands-on demos. This is a Skydio, which is one of many American-made companies. This particular model, the X10, is actually also fitted to launch from a platform that is a drone in a box, which is not the most technical term, but it can deploy and land on its own in its own charging and environmentally controlled station. And in fact, in Juneau here, you can go down to the Thane. So south of us, there is an avalanche area where we have a program using these types of drones to monitor for both mitigation and warning purposes down on at that site. And again, operators with Starlink, also noted on this slide, have the ability to remote launch and fly that either through a pre-programmed waypoint map. So you can pre-program and fly that exact route multiple times for comparison, or you can take manual control of that.
And we have another question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, something you just said, Mr. Mills, about the drone and Thane Road, you said avalanche mitigation. So do we have drones set up to drop stabilizing charges on avalanche-prone slopes?
Through the chair, to the co-chair, we actually have a slide later on and some props specifically for that conversation we'll be happy to touch on if that works.
And I have a question, too. When is the phase-out supposed to be completed on the DJI drones?
For the record, Christine Langley, Co-Chair Carrick, it's effective immediately, and so we cannot use DJI drones at this point on federally funded projects. We do, however, you know, this is something that we're aware of. We know how important drones are. We're actively pursuing what our options are. We already own, similar to the Skydio one that Mr. Mills mentioned, we own models that have all of the capabilities, so we just need to readjust where we have this placement around the state and readjust what we're purchasing in the future.
And for the record, Andy Mills, we've been in the process of phasing out or transitioning is the correct term, to Skydio and other products for, it's been at least 2 years I've been aware of. So it's been some time in the making. So this is not a reactionary effort, nor an unexpected one.
And as a follow-up question, is DOT able to gift or sell the DJI drones, or are they just completely not allowed to be used by any kind of private entity either?
Co-Chair Carrick, for the record, Christine Langley, Co-Chair Carrick, that's an excellent idea, and it's one that we have thought about. We don't have an answer yet today, but it's an area that we're looking at.
And for the record, Andy Mills, typically in some of our other assets, well, we do divest or dispose of those. The state equipment fleet is the one that comes to mind. We use an auction site to dispose of certain equipment. Typically in those scenarios, that ends up being local government has sort of a first right of refusal on some of those before it then goes to a public setting. But this may fall under something different, but as a comparable within the department on disposal property.
Please continue.
For the record, Christine Langley. Construction is an area that we use drones throughout the life cycle of the project. On the lower left, you can see an aerial image of a project. You can really tell how much more you can see as far as where the equipment is moving, what the slopes look like, where activity is occurring. And as Mr. Mills mentioned, our construction crews will pre-program a flight, and then that flight will be run over and over. And what that does is not only save those images, but it creates that three-dimensional model that you see on the right, on the lower right, and it allows them to monitor that change over time, in addition to recording a lot of aspects of what's going on in the construction site that someone might have not thought were significant at the moment or might not have written down, but it allows us to, you know, lessons learned and go back and look through those. The other benefit during construction of the 3D models, and you can see a section there highlighted in another color in red in the middle, is we use it to help quickly calculate volumes, which is the situation that would have taken surveying before, but we can fly the drone, calculate a volume. This could be material that's removed. This could be material that's placed. It could be seeding. And then that creates a situation where with less hours, we can pay out the contractor faster. One of the new things that we've done starting last summer is to bring those drones on site to the project in one step earlier. And so one of the items that we do between deciding that we're going to do a project and building out our what we call SSE, which is a scope, schedule, and estimate, is to get that drone up in the air and give those estimators a visual look at that project site. This can help them just get more information, right? Picture is worth 1,000 words. And we've started putting that step in place to help our estimates be more accurate or be better informed, maybe is the more technical term. The additional piece that the drones allow us to do is sometimes when we're going back and we are, versus a new installation of infrastructure, we're going back and redoing something that existed, is the drones help us see scenarios like, you know, does this guardrail still belong after the fact? Have we created a situation we weren't aware of? It allows us to get that aerial imagery. Our bridge section has reached the point where they consider drones to be such an important part that it's just a piece of the toolkit for every single team that they have that goes out in the field. As Mr. Mills mentioned, the ability to fly drones remotely not only gets information back, but it allows us to use our experts wherever they are. And so whether that is a drone in a box that gets deployed, whether that is an individual who may not be a bridge engineer but happens to be close and can fly the drone, the bridge team can then see what is being flown, or they can fly it themselves remotely. And this allows them to not only provide their expertise at the moment, but to make sure that the drone is looking at the areas that they need to get a closer eye on. This can be areas that are under the bridge deck, parts that would be otherwise hard to access.
And for the record, Andy Mills, on this particular slide, we don't have it visualized here, but I did want to mention there's some specialized equipment that goes along with certain drones. On bridge inspections in particular, I've seen an interesting, it's a kind of a ball or a cage that the drone sits inside, and it allows the drone to operate very close to that surface without bumping into it. And so it can roll along and you can do the visual inspection without sort of a concern of the wind or something else blowing, hitting one of those props and knocking it into the water below. And so there's some really neat technology that accompanies this method. And, of course, it's safer because you don't have the person in the bucket and the cherry picker kind of trying to get down on the side or rappelling in some way. So in addition to having eyes on it, it absolutely is safer. And there's some really interesting technology people have developed to utilize drones more efficiently on certain aspects like drone inspection or bridge inspection.
For the record, Christine Langley. So here is our slide on our drone use in avalanches. And actually, just last week, we tested a new detonation method for the canisters that I think Mr. Mills is going to demonstrate for us or show us here. These are mounted underneath the drone. And you can see that it, you know, in this case, we were training on the lower left there, so there isn't usually this many hands involved, but they were learning how to do it. For the first time, we succeeded in producing an air blast. And so traditionally, before last week, you would wait for that detonation device to hit the ground. But if we can activate that explosion about 2 meters or 8 feet above the ground, we can move a lot more material. We can have a much greater impact. And so for the first time last week, we were able to do that. This is an area in the department that we realize, you know, there can be some concern, right? But we have a lot of safety controls about this. The detonations can only occur in certain geo-fenced areas. We have a very robust training program to make sure that the pilots that are operating these drones are experienced in the software and the technology and understand what impacts they have.
And Andy Mills, for the record, on that particular canister, whether you can see it or I'll just describe it, there's a white dot on the top, and that's an air tag that you can place on the unit so that if it's unspent, if it does not detonate, it's easy to retrieve for the safety of the public. I didn't hear Ms. Langley say, so I'll mention that the cost difference between that and the current alternative, which is a howitzer shell. And yes, your security inspected this on the way in, so we're safe. But you can see it's a spent shell, spent ordnance from a howitzer. And I believe this is about $500, whereas that is about $50. It's an order of magnitude difference. And it's obviously safer from a number of aspects, but this is also quite heavy. And I'll pass this around for fun, too. So
I'm a little scared of Andy Mills holding a howitzer in our committee. That's amazing.
For the record, Christine Langley, the other thing that transitioning away from the howitzers and to the avalanches to the drones is doing for us is that we rarely see staff coming in with experience with a howitzer. We see quite a few staff who come in who have some experience with a drone. And while they might not be prepared to fly that drone that you see in the picture there, that, you know, it has a substantial size and cost to it, they have potentially flown a drone before, have played a video game, and our options for getting them trained up and ready are greater.
And for the record, Andy Mills, my understanding on the dropping ordnance by drones, I believe DOT was first in the nation for provisional authority with the FAA to receive the authorities necessary to put an explosive on a drone, which, as Ms. Langley said, is a sensitive, that's why we call it ordnance. But it's a safety factor also because, anecdotally, I heard if you park your car too closely to where the howitzer is being shot, it can destroy all your windows from the concussive blast and or potentially break legs if you're standing in the wrong place and pull. And it's a number of factors that make this drone ordnance much more safe as a program to operate. In addition to Alaska, among other states, they're also transitioning or wanting to transition away from howitzers as well. We're just farther ahead in that process and able to lend probably our expertise to other states that are transitioning as well.
For the record, Christine Langley, at our training last week, we also had members of a few Alaskan ski areas on site. We had individuals from the Alaska Railroad. So this is definitely an area where DOT is trying to help move the entire state forward in whatever reason they may need to mitigate avalanches.
And I think I have a couple questions there. Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, this is fascinating. I have a comment and a question. I would love a field trip to see this in action. I would really appreciate that as a committee, perhaps. Anyways, the question has to do with the drones and avalanches. I really appreciate the cost difference comparison. That's compelling. But I do a little outdoor adventuring. I do follow tragedies because if you learn about outdoor tragedies, you can hopefully avoid them. And as many of us know, is mid-February, there was a bad avalanche in Donner Pass, California, that took the lives of 8 people. I read the report about that. So what I'm curious about is, you know, an avalanche is, it's key to get people that are buried a breathing way, unburied within 30 minutes. And I do know the real-time crime center in Anchorage. I recently took a tour of that. And they're showing how drones with infrared cameras can see warm-blooded objects like a bad person who's hiding from police, and it can be really helpful for law enforcement, for everyone's safety. So have drones like this been outfitted with infrared cameras, and can they actually help locate avalanche victims under the snow, you know, and versus the old, you know, locate with your beacon and probe, especially in large-scale avalanches where there's several victims?
For the record, Andy Mills, to the co-chair. So I know in the case of a couple of years ago in Wrangell, there was the Zamovia landslide, tragically took the lives of several Alaskans, and drones were utilized in that response, and they were equipped with infrared so that we could tell among the wreckage where there were heat signatures to assist in a search and rescue effort. So we do have that capability, and I'll let Ms. Langley add to that.
For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair Eichheit. A couple years ago, there was an avalanche in the outside of the Girdwood area. We did assist the troopers, and we brought our drones. Our drone operators were on the flights with the troopers, and we did help. And so, again, towards that, our use of drones every day is what helps us be ready for that in the future.
Yeah,
follow up.
Just to really clarify, though, in that Girdwood avalanche, was infrared cameras used to help locate folks, or was it just visual?
Through the co-chair Eichheit, I don't want to misspeak on that, so I'd need to double check, but I can get back to you on it.
Yeah, just thank you. I'd appreciate that.
Yep, and we can work on a demonstration.
And I have a question as well, which is the smaller canister that you showed with those air tags. What's the recovery like on picking them up if they haven't detonated? So they have the air tag in case they haven't detonated. Seems like a dangerous operation to approach one that may be at risk of detonating. I'm just curious how that works.
Co-Chair Carrick, so we have done it one time. It does involve a long hike in the summer. And so we don't go and collect them right away in the winter conditions because those are avalanche zones that we're working in. We go back and we collect them in the summer. Everything on it has safety factors, right? And so many distinct pieces have to all come together in order for it to detonate. So the occurrence is that it does not detonate. And there is definitely still risk, and there's a mitigation strategy involved in going. Thankfully, we've only ever gone to retrieve one time.
And Andy Mills, for the record, any other mitigation measures also carry some of the same concern. I understand unspent ordnance is not unique to this deployment method. And also another technology I don't think we've highlighted in this presentation, but I believe it's a remote avalanche towers or RATs. Mm-hmm. Those are, of course, pre-established. You're buying donuts for everyone.
Second community, we got donuts.
So sorry.
Towers that are built in areas where there's a known avalanche mitigation path, and so the ordnance is placed at the top of the tower for remote deployment, and that can also, of course, result in unspent or ordnance that is inert or inactive and needs retrieval. So just making sure you know this deployment method, it doesn't create a unique scenario where there's something out there compared to other options.
Please continue. And yes, Representative Nelson owes donuts to this committee. Joke's on you this time, sir.
I apologize. That's karma right there.
For the record, Christine Langley. So innovation occurs through funding. It occurs when we kind of shuffle that deck sometimes. And so over the last year, you've watched some of our reorganizations. The items that you see on the screen and that I think we're going to get to show and tell, at least one of here, occurred through this, through the flexibility of some of our funding mechanisms and our highway safety improvement program. We were able to purchase extrication equipment, 42 sets for 14 EMS agencies. And so extrication equipment sometimes is called jaws of life. It's the item that an emergency services provider needs in order to assist in getting an individual out of a vehicle in a crash. It came to our attention that many of our remote locations did not carry these tools, and so they waited on site with an individual at a scene until someone else could bring it. And so this we saw a great need and an ability to put our efforts behind that. In addition, we have distributed over 800 sets of pilots, and pilots are effectively LED beacons that can be carried by a provider. They can be removed and set up. They will then link up to each other, and they can strobe in various patterns. So they can help someone who stops to deal with an issue on the side of the road direct traffic to the right or to the left. They can elevate, you know, oncoming individuals' awareness of the situation at hand. And then in addition to that, they can be linked up to 511. So the operator in the vehicle can hit a button, and immediately on 511 becomes an temporary work zone and an audible alert for oncoming traffic.
And we're in the danger zone now.
And Andy Mills, just to fill in maybe one more detail. So one benefit of the pilot, don't say pilots, otherwise you'll get those looks, is that, again, from a traditional road flare standpoint, road flares can be fairly inexpensive, especially when purchased in bulk. However, if you were to put six flares out and they're a couple dollars a piece, call it $18 maybe for that if you're buying in bulk. Well, this unit is at least retail, and I don't know comparatively, but $750 is what the going price is online. However, if you recharge these and they last you for 5+ years, you only need to have 42 incidents where this is used instead of the alternative to make it make fiscal sense. On top of that, this lasts up to 20 hours instead of 20 minutes. It doesn't have toxic fumes, which road flares can. And, of course, they just generally are safer to use around fuel or hazmat, where road flares are ill-advised. And so this is one of those situations where technology does create both a cost-effective alternative, especially when seen in the longer term, and something that has many other benefits that come with it.
And I'll go to Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And on the cost per flare, in my experience with it's mainly just a comment, like that these are actually a great use of funds. When I was on the rescue team in Sutton, those incidences last a long time. And you're not just putting one flare out because you don't want to go reset it. You're stacking three or four so they just light themselves and keep burning because you know you're going to be there for a long time. So these things are a tremendous, I think, resource for the state and do save money in the long run because go through flares like candy. The other thing, these jaws of life, we had these as well. And they can be used not only for, so this is just another comment, to extricate somebody, but we've had times where people were blocked or trapped under a vehicle, and I know that's not what they're used for, that's not what they're designed for, but you can jam those under a vehicle and get it lifted enough to get a bag under there so you can stabilize. So anyway, so just good job. Thank you.
And we have another question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Just a comment. First of all, the Jaws of Life, I had a chance to use that with Anchorage Fire Department during their Fire Ops 101 train that they had for legislators. Highly recommend that kind of experience where you put on the gear and we got to use the equipment, which is fascinating. The second thing is the pilot. I have these for my own personal vehicles. And they last a long time, and I use it because, you know, in Alaska we have things happen, and we tend to take care of ourselves, but we don't want to be struck while we're changing a tire on the side of the road or anything. And I have found them to be highly effective, and I just looked up the price, they're pretty cheap, the little private ones, you know, $30, $40, you can get a set, and much easier than flares, I think, even though not as exciting.
For the record, Christine Langley, in addition, through the co-chair Eichheit, the other feature of these is they're magnetic, and so they can actually be attached in many locations where flares would not be able to do what needs to be done. And on the lower right there, you will see a post that is from the Delta Fire Department, and they were actually, you know, unfortunately, but we were excited to make sure that, you know, that we had brought something to the table to help. They use their extrication equipment in a crash, and were able to get someone out, and so we're unfortunately happy that we could help. In the upper right, you'll see our Legends Need to Be Seen retro-reflective gear campaign. This is another area where Alaska has many hours of darkness, and we want to make sure that everybody is wearing retro-reflective gear. And so this is another area where we've been able to bring funding to the table to educate, to share resources, and to distribute some retro-reflective materials to the public.
And I'm really appreciating Mr. Mills being our flight attendant safety demonstrator here with how these things work. It's very great visuals in the room today.
For the record, Andy Mills. So I believe Miss Langley, I just want to give credit up front. The commissioner heard from the governor about a company that provided an innovative pedestrian light. So kudos to the governor for connecting these folks to my commissioner, who then gave a directive to Ms. Langley, and she didn't just walk, she ran with this. And there's right now, as we've talked in this committee, an active PED light in Kodiak. And I might let Ms. Langley give, again, a lot of kudos to Ms. Langley for getting that out the door very quickly. In concert with the vendor, and certainly the reception so far has been very positive, to where we're looking at other jurisdictions to place these. But
for the record, Christine Langley definitely takes a team, and you can see one of our M&O folks who is a volunteer tester down there in the lower left, and it's very clear how different that PED light makes in being able to see her. She is on the left, whether you can see it or not. Yes, you have to squint. That's not what we want out there on the roadway. So what the light does is it lights up the crosswalk on a regular basis to help remind traffic that it is there. And then as an individual approaches, it effectively shines a spotlight on them that follows them as they go. It works. We tested it with folks of all different sizes. We had an individual on a bike. We ran. We walked different directions. We changed our mind halfway through. And as of yet, we have not come up with a way to have it not function. So we were very excited to see that. And we appreciate all the individuals that stepped up to help us make this happen.
Question from Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, so we were talking about cost differentials before. What's the cost differential between these dynamic crossing lights and the standard light crossing, which has no dynamic light, please?
Through the Co-Chair Eichheit, I'm not sure that's quite apples to apples, but I could tell you how much the AI pedestrian light costs, if that would work. All right. So we do need an electrician, and we need the right situation. So we need a marked crosswalk at an unsignalized intersection. And if all of that comes together, then the unit itself is $37,000 with a $1,000 yearly cost to keep it updated and be able to ensure that it functions and edit it year to year.
Thank you.
And Andy Mills, for the record, on this in particular, when the mayor of Kodiak came to visit, they had inquired about the light being on, the crosswalk being illuminated at all times. And Ms. Langley had actually worked in that situation where the light that was there had been, the wiring for that had, I believe, been used for this unit. And so it was left on to illuminate the crosswalk at all times. Some folks wondered if that was a malfunction. It was actually intentional. So in some sense, the light is already painting the sidewalk in addition to the pavement painting that you will see for striping. And then the extra light would come on, and it would, on top of that base light, illuminate that pedestrian and as they go across. So in some sense, you could tell where the crossing was from afar just by how it was illuminated. And then once you crossed, additional illumination for that pedestrian. So it was not the original intent necessarily to have a crosswalk always illuminated with light, but we're hearing from some of the residents they would prefer to keep that on, keep that feature that way. So you can see the versatility depending on the location. And I found it fascinating to learn that the AI algorithm is trained per location because every intersection and area you deployed is different and has to learn the specifics of that area. So,
for the record, Christine Langley, one of the other things, and you can see this in the image where you can see the pedestrian walking, is that the crosswalk is not that marked that well, right? And so Kodiak is one of our areas that, because of their climate, struggles with that paint lasting as long as it might last in other areas. And yet the continued light and the fact that it lights the pedestrian helps when that paint marking might be obscured from snow, could be, you know, worn in an area, or someone just doesn't notice it.
And one more for Andy Mills, for the record. Just in Anchorage in particular, with the pedestrian fatality issue, it is obviously on our radar to look for opportunities to deploy this in areas in Anchorage. Again, as we testified before, what we wanted to do was take a lower volume road and test this technology out during the wintertime, because the worst thing you could do is deploy something that then creates additional issues. And so this is really, again, with a dynamic partner at Kodiak, where they embraced testing this at this intersection. Or this crosswalk, this is really for us to learn if this works. And so far, I'm hearing nothing but positive. And so this, just to get ahead of where else are you going to deploy these, it's a to be determined. There are a number of areas that have asked, given the news. But Anchorage is absolutely on our list of areas to look for those opportunities affirmatively and work with partners there.
Follow up?
We have a follow up. And also, I'm just going to say, too, I love that we are in the danger zone. It feels very appropriate for this committee, but the lights are bugging my eyes. So if we could,
I thought it was just me.
If we could, I love the pie lights demonstration, though.
On a plus side, they got your attention, right? So they did their job.
They put us appropriately in the danger zone. Okay, I'll go to Co-Chair Eichheit.
Yeah, just as a follow-up, thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. You know, you brought up the Anchorage pedestrian issues, fatalities, and I think, you know, one of the things I have heard is people are not crossing at crosswalks, and there are some big stretches of busy roads that for whatever reason, people don't want to, well, because we're humans, we don't like to walk a long ways to go to a crosswalk. And so I'm very interested in this technology or simpler ones that use lights, because I do know when I was in Hawaii about a little over a year ago, they had in a busy area a very simple thing. You press a button and then LED lights flash on a pedestrian. It's a pedestrian crossing, but it gets driver's attention, and it's operated by the person that wants to cross. Might be cheaper. But I really love this idea and how it can be incorporated as we can afford it.
For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair, Co-Chair Eichheit, the system that is installed in Kodiak doesn't require any active participation from the pedestrian, and that was one of the things that we were really excited, is that if you just walk up, you've turned it on. You don't have to do anything, think about it, whatever. The other item that we're interested in researching long term is, does the fact that it's lit draw, you know, adjust that human nature aspect and get people to cross at the crosswalk who might not otherwise? So in installing this, I got to watch a lot of pedestrians in Kodiak, and quite a few of them did not necessarily cross at the crosswalk because it was not their most efficient path. And I think because it is based on human nature and what all of us, you know, tend to do or take a shortcut, I am wondering if having the light there will get people engaged in walking that little extra bit. And so we'll see if that plays out.
Thank you.
All right. Please continue.
So moving on to some other AI-supported operations around the state asset collection. Assets come in all types for the department. That is where we have crosswalks. It's how many cars go through. It's what class they might be. It's lane miles. It's road conditions. And so AI has been used in many sections of the department. And we'll start in the upper right. We are using it to do predictive road surface conditions. So this system ingests a lot of data feeds from various places, and it can help M&O get an idea of what might be coming and what treatment might be appropriate. So, you know, if that temperature dips down to a certain point at 3 a.m., that road surface that was wet might be shifting to icing, and their treatment might then be different. And so the system helps them with that. On the lower right is a system that we have in pilot now, and 70 of these units arrived last week, and we're going to be installing them around the state. These not only show us where the vehicle has been, they use AI to help our SEF crew understand the codes that come out of the engines of the equipment, and these will be on heavy equipment and light-duty vehicles. It helps us know, do we need to pull that piece of equipment out of the fleet right now and deal with it, or could it come in for service in its next regularly scheduled cycle? And then on the left, you can see the real-time road conditions. And so at any point when they're out there, if they need assistance or if we have questions, you can watch that live feed to see what that looks like. And this can come in really handy when M&O operators are out on the roadway, they're trying to explain something that or conditions that they see, and someone from the back can help them, or even just get eyes on, yes, that is a lot of snow, yes, that tanker is sideways, whatever is going on out there. These video data feeds allow us to collect assets automatically. And so as you look over towards the left, there are two methods there, or two systems there that we use. One is a van that drives the state and collects data as it goes. You can see that it's picking up where the roads are, the lanes are. It identifies signals, signs, guardrails, sidewalks, and in the little image on the lower left, but towards the right, you can see a crosswalk that has been identified through AI and is now going to be placed on the map for further analysis. They can also help tell us how the quality of the striping or the crosswalk, and that's very useful as well. We're hoping to be able to start generating that work list out of there of this is a crosswalk we need to address and paint again. In the upper left, we are required to not only count traffic, but classify the types of vehicles that are on our roadway. And it used to be that we needed to cut the asphalt. We had to set up traffic control. We had to stop people from crossing the lanes. We had to cut the asphalt. We installed loops underneath the ground. They have a lifespan. We might have to do it again. But now, all of the equipment is mounted on that pole on the left. The pole can be leaned down by the individual who's working on it so that any maintenance that needs to occur can be done easily without a lift truck. And it not only is counting the traffic, but it's classifying them in real time. And so we're getting that information back. We have several more of these on the way, and we're hoping to start being able to use these to have a short-term better understanding of traffic conditions when we need to or when we're having conversations with the public. All of this data gets turned into information products. And so one of the items that we have been working on recently in support of the LNG pipeline is to take a lot of that asset condition and aggregate it all into a map that can be used by the public. On the lower left there, you can see the ratings of the existing asphalt roadway. You can see where material sites are and what their permitting status might be. You can look at the existing oil pipeline, the proposed LNG line. And then for the first time, we have developed a methodology to rate gravel roads, which is I'm not even sure needed by the Lower 48. But either way, we're leading the way. And we now have a rating on gravel roads that are part of the Dalton Highway. Okay, back into the slightly cooler toys. So one of the things that we have a smart grant to help with avalanche detection and mitigation. And so while the drone is an excellent resource, it does not necessarily solve all problems in all areas at all times. And so a system we recently put up is a radar. This is along the Seward Highway. It was installed 2 months ago now, I guess. It needs to visually see the avalanche path, and so that defines where it can go. And as the avalanche is triggered, it detects it. It can alert individuals through apps on their phones. And then we're moving to that next phase where we hope to be able to alert the public and the traffic that's traveling. And so right now we're working on fine-tuning QA, QCing the information that's coming from that system. And we hope to be able to put up visible lights, as you see in the lower right, that alert traffic if it's detected an avalanche that they should, you know, either be aware or stop altogether. The next system that we have in place is infrasound. So this you can think of more as listening to for an avalanche. This can do things that are beyond its line of sight. So it can detect an avalanche that might be over the next ridge or 360 degrees around it. And so that gives it a lot more flexibility, but sound waves bounce in unexpected ways. So we're still working on the QAQC for this piece as well. We've installed one of these along the Seward Highway this year, and we have one of these in Thane Road, and we've seen it detect for the first time this last year, which was exciting. And then again, all of these are proactive, so as opposed to waiting for the call that the snow is down, we know conditions are shifting.
And Andy Mills, for the record, I'll just note this slide and the last slide are certainly good examples of ways that trying to put technology where we might not have personnel as readily available, and just given, again, the rural and remote nature of our state, finding ways to provide safety in areas where it's harder to get to. So, again, technology providing safety enhancements and opportunities in a challenging operational environment.
For the record, Christine Langley, the third recent avalanche response, which we also did not bring this one for show and tell, is our mobile boom whoosh. So this is a trailer mounted device. You can kind of think of it as a potato gun, as one of our staff affectionately describes it. It creates an air blast that dislodges material along the roadway. And so this has been tested in Thompson Pass. It is currently outside of Girdwood and was tested there again the other day. And it has great benefits in that, similar to the avalanches, unlike the howitzers, which require a vast amount of mitigation efforts, clearing the roads, bringing the equipment, setting up the traffic control, and then being able to launch, this one has the capacity to move much quicker, handle smaller potential avalanches, so bring down smaller amounts of material, allow us to clear it faster and keep that road open or open that road again in shorter time.
Well, okay. You're telling me we didn't get a mobile boom whoosh in this committee room? No. I'm joking, of course.
we got to three. I thought we were doing good.
You're doing great.
So innovation happens in a lot of non-boom whoosh methods, right? And so one of those has been an expansion on our GIS team, which has been able to, for the first time, really turn the STIP into something that the public can get a hold of. It was a multi-hundred page document. It can be hard to read. It can be hard to find what you might be interested in. But as of this last cycle and going into our next STIP cycle, it now is an item that the public can slice and dice however they want. If you want to look by strategic investment area, if you're interested in your particular district, if you want to know your community, if you're after things that are on the Glen Highway, you can search for all of that information and not only know what is coming, but get a comparison of how the STIP changes over time. This slide has several other ways that we've been able to turn that data into information. Starting on the upper right is a recent addition. This is an award dashboard. This goes back many years, and you can use this to see all of the construction-related awards that Alaska DOT is making. You can look up and see what prime vendors are participating in those. You can see all of the subs that have been hired. It gives you a really good idea of how many contracting entities are working in the state of Alaska. You can see the awarded price. You can see the price, the current award, which that sometimes can be changed due to change orders. And then you can see the paid to date. And so this really gives a lot of visibility into the contracting process. On the lower right is a new permitting system that we released in the last year. This is new to the state of Alaska. We have had a few online permitting systems, but we still had systems that were solely paper-driven. And so this has provided the ability for individuals and entities to apply from anywhere online and to watch their permit progress over time and have an idea of where it is in the queue and who they can talk to if they have questions. On the lower left is our winter operations dashboard. This allows you to see where equipment has been over time. You can look back in, again, anywhere in the state that you want to take a look, Juneau, Anchorage, and Fairbanks, that you want to take a look and see where maintenance vehicles have been. It also pulls in the relevant ARWIS, or Road Weather Information System, cameras in that area so that you can also get a visual of the road at this moment. In the upper left is our 511 system. This has ARWIS cameras. We have recently updated it to include more focus pages that include municipal cameras in the greater Anchorage area, and we're expanding that across the state. You can see that there's two bridges. Maybe you can see that there's two bridges in that image. It now can announce bridge heights so that you know clearance levels as you're about to approach a bridge. It has digital message signs in some areas of the state on there, and then it can tell you the current speed of traffic, which gives you an indication of how comfortable people feel with the roadway. Oh, and right in the middle, thank you, right in the middle is the Typhoon Halong dashboard. So again, this is an area where we really saw all these individual skills that we had been working on investing in the department come together in a hurry to stand up the state's first common operating picture and not only make changes for Alaska, but changes to how FEMA will be operating going forward. And so this was definitely a big win, and kudos to all of the individuals that worked on that. So we have many items that we already own, and we've got some great folks who are innovating the use of existing tools and expanding them. And so this is an area where M&O has taken a conventional tractor that had only been used seasonally for mowing and parked in the winter and turned it into a piece of equipment that they can use year-round. So on the lower left, you'll see that it has some snow clearing equipment mounted on the front. And on the right, you'll see that it has a blower, and it's moving along a sidewalk there and filling a truck. And this has taken, that same piece of equipment we've had and really been able to maximize its usage in our fleet. This next one is a dock in Ketchikan. And so Ketchikan has a unique scenario in that it has a narrow channel, a prevailing direction of wind, and the vessels, the AMHS vessels that need to dock, are docking astern, which means they're effectively backing into their parking spot. This was causing abrupt docking to and subsequently damage to both the dock and potentially to our vessels, right? Hard hits are not good for any system. One of our engineers out of Juneau here was able to design a system that changed how those forces were happening. It provided some cushion between the dock and the vessel. And as the vessel moors astern, if you hit the dock at an angle, right, you might catch the back end of the vessel. And so that was a really hard challenge to overcome, and he was able to design a system that slowly cradled that vessel as it came in and docked. And so this was a pretty big win for us and is going to extend the life of the dock and the life of the vessel. So going back to traffic, one of the areas we've really been focused on is getting ready for that traffic of the future. And so we've been working to modernize the systems that we have and, again, turn that data into information. On the top right, you can see the active speed, real-time speed information of vehicles that are operating along that stretch of roadway. And this is a really critical piece for us. We can design roads, we can put up signs, we can, you know, have beacons, but how individuals use the road is still a critical component, and we need to be able to understand that. And so this system is helping us see the conditions that are really happening out there. On the far right-hand side, you can see some of the times that individuals are waiting at signals. This is another one where, again, human nature, none of us like to wait at a red light. And so we know that that can affect how people act when they are in those situations. And we want to make sure that that timing is fine-tuned as well as we can to help individuals move through and reduce safety conflicts. On the lower middle portion, you'll see a stretch of the Glen Highway there. This is an instance where we were able to, the system was able to detect and alert us to a rapid slowdown in speed. And so traffic went from 59 or 39 miles to 36, dropped by 36 miles to 3 miles. At that point, we know if people are moving 3 miles an hour, we've got a serious condition that has all of a sudden happened. And so we are now able to edit the digital message boards throughout the state from anywhere, and that no longer requires an individual who happens to be right there, who happens to notice it or waits for a call to come in, for us to be able to put up a message to the public on 511 and on those signs that advises caution ahead due to conditions.
And Andy Mills, for the record, as we're starting to get into the home stretch of the final portion of the presentation, I just wanted to say, when you said innovation as the topic for today, we sort of, I mean, not everything is quite as flashy as the pilot, but we did want to give you kind of the mundane, the magical stuff that's in it, very innovative. And some of these may seem mundane, but they're absolutely essential innovations, much more practical. A lot of these, you'll see there's internal and external, high tech, low tech. So we kind of, again, I know some of these are maybe not as flashy, but there's a full gamut of innovation in the department we wanted to highlight. And I think some of the last slides draw some of those threads together.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I think one thing, too, just hearing about the ability to see those dangerous slowdowns is, does DOT have any kind of, when you see something go down to an average rate of speed of 3 miles an hour, is that like the kind of situation we would immediately notify the troopers and have that cross-working relationship? Maybe even troopers are deployed before the accident has been called in, kind of thing. Has that happened?
Co-Chair Carrick, quite often when we do see this, we immediately notify the MNO individuals in that area. We start talking to the folks who would be on the ground to vet that information. We don't want to react if we're not sure. And so we're still in that phase where we're making sure that is it this generally the condition? But we do have folks who are monitoring that. In a couple slides, we'll talk about how we're hoping to get to that ideal state for us. But we do. We are in close contact with DPS. They, you know, will ask us to put something up. We will talk to them about a condition that we see.
That's amazing. I just think about all the times on the parks where I've not had any cell service, and the fact that DOT might know about a potential situation and already have contacted the appropriate trooper post in the future. That's just like an amazing thing that we would be able to do. And I was behind, I think there ended up being a 5-hour road closure on the parks that I was behind a major, major multi-vehicle motorcycle accident a few years ago. And it took first responders, I think, 45 minutes to arrive. It was at a really unfortunate spot on the Parks Highway. And we don't think of the Parks Highway as being that remote, but this kind of technology actually would really change the outcome potentially in that situation. So it's really interesting. Co-Chair Eichheit also has a question.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the co-chair, this slide stimulated a question in my mind. I don't think I'm probably the only one that has it in their mind. So I used to commute daily from Anchorage to Palmer when I worked for the Matsu Borough. And just on the outbound Glen near the, I'm not sure the milepost, but it's you know, pretty close to the Arctic Valley exit. There's what we call the $1 million sign. And on my daily commute, I was always surprised by how little used it was. So can you tell me the function of those signs? And could you also tell me, do you anticipate with 511 technology and such that you're maybe not going to use those as much in the future? I mean, I do want to say I would appreciate if there was information on there, but it was very, very, very rarely lit up. with anything. So any comment on the so-called million-dollar sign?
Dollar sign.
Do you want that? For the record, Christine Langley, this gets to be a complicated topic to answer, right? Because, again, if we put up information all of the time, it becomes something that people disregard. You are completely correct. We have not used them as much over the last several years if we have used them in the last year. And so in the last year, we've started that what you see on the slide there on the lower left, who hates speeding tickets, and the next screen will say, raise your right foot. And so we're trying to really start getting people to engage with the signs, to use the signs, and to provide that information that you're talking about. That particular sign, we have in one event in Anchorage where we saw that we knew it was Friday afternoon, the weather was declining rapidly, conditions were changing. We did put up a sign right on the spot that said, please use caution, you know, winter storm ahead or winter conditions. But it is a piece that we recognize that we may not have been using to its full potential in the past, but we intend to change that. Those signs can also be read on 511. We do want to be careful because 511, the last thing we want to do is say, well, we're going to turn off the signs, so you should all use your phone in your car. And so there, as I think you might have heard our traffic and safety engineer, Pam Golden, talk about it, Swiss cheese, right? And we want to always catch so that nobody makes it through a hole from one side to the other, and these digital message boards are part of that.
Yeah, Andy Mills, for the record, I was the Juno boy was hoping maybe someone had the million-dollar sign. I don't have much on that. That was before my time at the department, even though the Glen Christmas tree and other things are on my radar. But for dynamic message, is it dynamic messaging signs, DMS? Okay. We are looking at some other locations where we would put those. So those are not, shall we say, legacy systems that we wouldn't be installing additional. In fact, DPS partners have talked about the need for some additional locations on those. I know one we've talked with Senator Bjorkman, the chair of Senate Transportation, about is at the Y on the peninsula. And that's a good example of an area where you can get to some areas where it's hard, south signal-wise, or, again, we don't want people nursing or watching their phones while they're driving. And so giving indicators about events or critical issues on the roadway is still of benefit to the driving public, and we're trying to find out where that technology can be deployed, especially for, again, remote, rather than visiting the site and trying to get something up. If you can basically hear something's happening and get that changed quickly, you'll see the theme with extrication tools, information, everything else. Speed is important, right? How quickly can we get that information out? And so, anyway, just so I know, there are actually additional areas that are under consideration for implementation of new dynamic signing.
Yeah, just a brief follow up. I understand the, you know, not over messaging folks. I guess my concern being a winter commuter is, you know, there are some pretty sketchy days doing that commute, and the sign remained unused, and I would count how many vehicles were in the median or ditch. And I think sometimes folks need a little reminder on the really sketchy days. But I like the technology. I'm always concerned when you have something. Well, it's got an unfortunate nickname. I'm not sure what the real cost was, but when you see something that has a perception of investment and it's not used much, and I heard what you said that maybe there's an effort to use it a little more. I don't want to say breed skepticism in infrastructure investments, but I appreciate the sign. I would like people to slow down on those sketchy days, but I think it's innovation in its own right. Thank you.
For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair, I said we recognize that, and thank you for that comment, and we'll definitely work towards a solution. So one of the next steps is getting ready for the connected transportation system of the future. And so as we see more connected vehicles on the roadway, we need to have that connected infrastructure to back it. And while individually we might, you know, a person can choose never to own a connected vehicle, the algorithms that are out there are still affecting our transportation system. And so we saw several instances last summer of Google Maps deciding that one direction of the Parks Highway was closed. And it simply made that decision for us because the connected vehicles that were on the roadway had shifted in a construction zone to a alternative path. And it simply, from now on, told everyone who wanted to drive south that they were going to need to go the long way. And so we have to step up and start participating in this world, and these are some of our first steps to do that. On the lower left, you'll see a unit that can be attached to any car. This becomes very important for us in how fast we can move it to various locations. And so we ran a test corridor, which you see in the upper right there. And this unit creates not only a LiDAR point cloud, which can be used for 3D modeling, but identifies assets as it goes. And it's a little hard to see in that image, but this is the GARS intersection, which was a relatively new intersection at that time. And what you'll notice in there is that the actual roads don't match the imagery that is easily available to the public. And so this becomes... It just demonstrates how fast we need to get this information out there so that connected vehicles are following the correct lanes and the current, you know, set of things that are in reality, not the last image that they may have pulled in. In the bottom right, it feeds in copious amounts of data that we can then use to meet our federal reporting as well. So to get to your point, Madam Co-Chair, we are currently designing a joint traffic operations center. And so we know just from, you know, what we've experienced over the last couple of years that this isn't something that we need to pay attention to on occasion. We need to start staffing for this as reality. And so we are working in conjunction with the Department of Public Safety, DPS, on a joint traffic operations centers that will locate their dispatch with our traffic operations. And this will really not only boost the information that's available to both of our agencies, but cut costs as far as maintaining a system like this. What we are doing now is developing that concept of operations on how do we actually interconnect these systems? How do we ensure security, ensure safety, and yet make sure that the moment that DPS needs to know information on the roadway, we've got somebody who can pull up the appropriate traffic camera or ARWIS camera for them. On the flip side, you know, quite often in an event, we will be the ones who know what a rural airport's runway condition is. We know the infrastructure and availability at of our vessels and our harbors. And so this information sharing back and forth is greatly beneficial to both of our departments. From that location, we don't intend to remove any of the traffic operation centers that exist in the regions today, but right now they don't all speak the same language, so we're not able to help each other out in an emergency. And building out this kind of fourth leg of that tripod is going to give us the ability to start having statewide conversations, ingest all of this information that comes along with that internet of vehicles, and jumpstart us, as one of our folks put it, from a flip phone to a smartphone. And so we're really looking forward to that.
And Andy Mills, for the record, so this is an area of innovation where many other states' peers actually already have operations centers. So Alaska, in some sense, is catching up to what many of our peers out there have as far as operations centers that are sort of looking statewide. However, much like my trip to Myanmar years ago, it was interesting to see that if you don't build out, you can leapfrog. And so in some sense, I think the timing Director Langley has on this, we're going to be able to set up a center that is incorporating the best of the current state of technology in that operations center. I think, again, well served by a unification of information in a joint operations center.
We have a question from Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the Co-Chair, on the presentation that you gave earlier on the, I mean, I hate to do this, to pull this document, but, you know, the from principles to structure, you know, where it laid out your guys' new or your desired plan here, where is this going to fall on this flow chart? On, you know, just for the committee's benefit, it's page 6 of the presentation that was given. Where is that going to fall?
Through the co-chair, Representative Nelson, this is one of the cross-functional sections. This is the one that you see called out as Data and Modernization, Innovation, and the Highway Safety Office.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
And so our last slide is some of those next steps that are coming. And so one of the things that we are about to kick off is a connected corridor. This is going to allow us to put the information sharing units on along the side of the roadway along one road and start to really test what those information, what that sharing can do, those messages go back and forth. When you have a situation like this, it can't be what I saw on the digital message board miles ago. It can't be what I heard on the radio. It has to be sub 10 millisecond signals that are going back and forth. And so this is a piece that we want to be very diligent about as we develop it, and we want to start working along one corridor. Using this, we're going to be able to outfit or retrofit some of our EMS providers and transit providers with units on board so that they can preemptively change the signal timing and be able to get to the hospital as fast as they can, cross town as efficiently as possible with their passengers, items like that. We are also putting in place two systems. DriveWise is geared towards commercial operators. It lets them know things like there's a bridge ahead, there's a steep grade, I see a rapid slowdown in traffic, and help them be safe and be, the rest of us be safe as they move through their daily operations. The other one, which we are calling Alaska Alerts, goes towards your comment, Madam Chair, and that is, this is a system that during an event will allow us to geofence an area, and we can then send a signal to all cell phones that are in that location and ask them if they would like to opt in to communicating with us. That will be our opportunity to ask if they're safe and, you know, warm in their vehicle, give them additional information on the situation ahead. They can let us know if they see things that we can't see at the moment, or do they need assistance because they're running out of fuel. Pieces like that, which really, you know, while we will continue to alert on our digital message boards, 511, our social media channels, it's just one more way that we can have directed, proactive conversation with the public about safety. So thank you very much. We really appreciate the invitation. We always like the opportunity to bring along some of our cool toys, but also we're very excited about where this is taking us in the future and how we're able to take some of these things that were innovations like drones and put them into daily practice so that we're ready for emergencies.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Ms. Langley. And we have a couple questions. We'll go to Representative Mina.
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, thank you for the presentation. Always really interesting and awesome to hear the good work that DOT is doing to move forward. I'm curious how you, MPOs are also doing similar data work, and especially I'm just thinking about how with Anchorage, they've made a lot of progress to make it easier for folks to figure out to track snow plowing and snow maintenance. So how do you integrate work that MPOs are also doing for data tracking, and will that also be part of the work that you're doing?
For the record, Christine Langley, through the co-chair, Representative Mina, that's an excellent question and excellent idea. And a couple weeks ago, we had a meeting with, I believe, Matsu. I think Anchorage was invited, but it is towards that exact point of it shouldn't be the public's responsibility to know which road it is. And at the end of the day, if I need to get from my home to the airport, I don't want to look on four dashboards, right? And so we all use a similar back end to the system, and we're going to start finding ways to transfer that data so that we develop one that is plow status for Alaska, and we get to basically anyone who opts in, we will share that data. And so DOT is prepared to front that and put that forward.
Follow up?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. That's awesome, and that's great to hear, because I'm always like switching between different websites to figure out, like, okay, is there snow on the ground or what is plowed? I have a separate question. So, you know, just thinking about this autonomous vehicles conversation, technology is moving very fast, and, you know, some of our statutes are a little bit outdated. And so how are you, are there areas in our statutes where we do need to be more mindful about updating the law to help you all as you continue to pursue different innovation and technology in DOT?
So Andy Mills, for the record, through the co-chair to Representative Mina, I believe in at least the conversation about the legislation that this body has heard, Mr. Ben Glenn gave some testimony on a federal framework that's under current work in Congress. I believe it was the SAFE drive. Anyway, man, but he gave the bill, the HR bill number. And certainly states can, and some states have, sort of put frameworks in place, but ultimately on something that is a national technology and a national sort of consumer related issue, a federal framework, having it by default rather than by design, rather than forming its own way by default, is of course beneficial for sort of laying that groundwork. I mean, I'm aware of the federal legislation, but certainly our hand in that is communicating with our congressional delegation about what we see are the benefits of that or any concerns we may have. But ultimately, I think from a framework, having a national framework makes a lot of sense in an area like this. So as far as state-specific, that'll depend on what the considerations are. So I guess maybe from a department standpoint, we're in a wait and see on some of the technology because we're not fully autonomous at this point. And I know the point of the legislation was to get ahead of some developments. But we're also, I understand there's maybe someone live streaming their commute. And so that there's some of this is already at our doorstep. But we're looking to that national framework and how that might fill in where state statutes would not be necessary or would be in addition to.
Thank you. That's a great question. We'll go to Representative Nelson.
Thank you. And this is a great reminder. Yeah, Ben said it was the federal bill was 7390, and I need to look that up, so thank you for that reminder. My question was on the system on slide 11 that you talked about that you're using to monitor particular pieces in your fleet currently on the bottom right there. Is that Samsara, or what's the system that you're using to do that?
Yes, that's Samsara. I'm sorry, through the co-chair, Representative Nelson. I was careful, but yes, that is Samsara.
All right, thank you.
Sweet. Okay. I don't see any additional questions at this time, and I just want to thank our presenters, Ms. Langley and Mr. Mills. We really appreciate this really great overview, look into some of the ways that DOT is incorporating and innovating with technology, and it's really impressive, some of the tools that are being used. Co-Chair Eichheit?
Thank you, Co-Chair Carrick. Through the Co-Chair, just a last-second question. Since you didn't bring the robotic dog down, the question is, does the robotic dog bark?
To the co-chair, there are so many things that that Boston Dynamics dog can do. Again, I'm sure it could actually play Bruce Springsteen and other things if you wanted it to. Optional flamethrower we have not opted in on. But there's quite a bit that it can do. And from a wildlife hazing standpoint, I do understand that we've entertained what sounds it would need to make. That's part of the pilot. And also maybe even putting something on it to mimic a prey look. There's so much that one can do with that platform. I understand at Universal Studios there's even a toothless dragon that is one of those that's entertaining guests. So that this platform obviously can be deployed for a multitude of purposes.
Follow up. So I just, you know, this is not meant to be a commentary, but I do know with technology, throughout the history of technology, folks have always been fearful of how it might change or threaten their jobs. And I do know canines are used in a variety of working applications. So I suspect maybe my canine friends are probably worried about robotic dogs taking their jobs away. But nothing replaces the real thing for in-home love. So anyways, thank you.
Wow, what a beautiful commentary. thank you again for this presentation. And with that, House Transportation is concluded for today. Our next hearing is on Tuesday, March 10th at 1 p.m. I will have to look again. I know we do have a topic from Department of Transportation we're preparing for. We also will have a first hearing on the bill from Representative Nelson's office. So those are both coming up next week. With nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned at 2:24 p.m.